So good morning, and I'd like to welcome those who have arrived a bit later who weren't here yesterday evening. Some of you I know have travelled a long way and have had some difficult things to deal with as well. So a warm welcome to you for this Bodhisattva Ideal Retreat, Going for Refuge Retreat on that theme. And as I said last night, what I'm going to do this morning is to hopefully provide some orientation for the study. We're studying this in some ways not entirely easy text, although it's wonderfully clear. It's done in a particular, what they call the Alankara style, the sort of choice jewel-like quotations from the sutras and commentaries woven into a sort of manual for, in this case, Bodhisattva training, looking at the six paramitas. This is from Kampopa, the great disciple of Milarepa, who wasn't just a yogi, but schooled in the great graduated path to enlightenment tradition stemming from Atisha, from the great Kadampa tradition, a monastic. It's a kind of monastic textbook. He's one of the great pioneers of the Kagyu school, Kampopa, establishing one of its first monasteries. So I want to begin by speaking a bit personally about my sort of first encounters with the Bodhisattva ideal. And they're thrilling encounters as far as I'm concerned. My first, I didn't know I was encountering the Bodhisattva tradition, was back in a private house in an area just outside of Brighton called Preston Park. This house was owned by some very lovely people who ran the Brighton Buddhist Society. And they were hosting at that time an order member named Buddhadasa, who was starting classes in Brighton with a view to start a centre. Buddhadasa is one of the great pioneer order members. I don't know how many centres he's started, but there's quite a few. He's back in Australia right now. How many?
Seven
centres he's started. So there you are. I didn't know Buddhadasa was an aspiring Bodhisattva at that time, but clearly he is. But my first class was rather unusual, because in those unsystematic days, I didn't get a graduated introduction to the mindfulness of breathing with lots of sort of focus on body awareness and all that sort of thing. It was a full dress, 5-stage metta bhavana. There was instruction for that. And then the sevenfold puja. First contact. And thank goodness it was, as far as I'm concerned. I did have my head full of Tibetan Buddhism. I'd read the works of Lama Govinda. So I'd probably read about the Bodhisattva ideal in those books, because Lama Govinda's deeply inspired by that ideal. By the end of the puja, I knew I was going to devote my life to Buddhism. I was 17. I didn't know anything about anything, really. And I certainly didn't know what living the Buddhist life was. I actually knew I was going to be an order member, and I'd only met one, you know, an hour and a half before or something like that. I don't know how I knew. I just knew. Very, very directly. That's why I have a great fondness and faith in the Sevenfold Puja. What I didn't know was that the Sevenfold Puja came from a great text on the Bodhisattva path, Shantideva's Bodhicharavatara. It comes in the section called Embracing the Bodhicitta, or establishing or grasping even the Bodhicitta. And the way he does that is through giving praise and expressing his gratitude and sense of wonder at the arising of the Bodhicitta. And that is expressed as worship of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and also a very strong confession of faults. I didn't know that at the time. So the Sevenfold Puja is regarded as one of the great practices to bring about the arising of the Bodhicitta, the if you like, the force or the will of wisdom and compassion initially in its rudimentary form, arising in us and then becoming a force that, as it were, takes us over, so that we practice the Dharma, we live enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, even to bring about the enlightenment of all beings. The language of the Bodhicitta is bringing out the whole cosmic significance of Buddhist practice, that we're not just doing it for ourselves, we're doing it to bring about the complete liberation of each and every single living being. In other words, the language of the Bodhicitta, the Bodhisattva ideal, is not putting any ceiling on spiritual development, on development in the Dharma life. There is no end, in a sense, to the path. Enlightenment itself isn't an end. It's a horizon that we move towards, and we move into unimaginable dimensions of Dharma life. And of course, there's no end to living beings. So we're constantly going to be living the Dharma life for the benefit of all, in ways that we can't imagine at this moment in time as we fumble along. So I didn't know it, but the Sevenfold Puja came from the Bodhisattva tradition. Not long after that, Buddhadasa was, a senior disciple of Bhante, and in those days, one of the ways we studied the Dharma was to listen to Bhante's tape lectures, and they really were tape lectures in those days. I mean, reel-to-reel tapes. It was just before cassettes came in, so it shows how long ago it was, in the mid-1970s. And I think probably around this time, I must have heard Bhante's lecture series on the Bodhisattva ideal, aspects of the Bodhisattva ideal, which is a really wonderful lecture series. And he starts that series by talking about the Buddha, telling wonderful stories about the Buddha, saying that what the Bodhisattva ideal comes from is the example of the Buddha himself, the way the Buddha communicated, the way he was with people, the way he interacted. He told stories of the Buddha's compassion, the Buddha's love of silence and profound meditation, and so on. And he says, really, that's where the Bodhisattva ideal comes from. It comes from the living example of the Buddha, because when you take the Bodhisattva vow, you're vowing to become a fully enlightened Buddha who will rediscover the way when it's actually been lost. That's what you're dedicating yourself to. But the lecture that really struck me was on the arising of the Bodhicitta. I think it's called The Awakening of the Bodhi Heart. I found this, for reasons I still don't understand, an absolutely thrilling lecture. I guess, sometimes different kinds of Dharma really speak to you. Presumably it's something to do with your own consciousness, the own way, perhaps your own your own resonances, and perhaps even nascent Dharma experiences. But I was very, very struck when he started to talk about the Bodhicitta. He referred to a work by the great Acharya Nagarjuna, before that, he says, Bodhicitta is often translated as the thought of enlightenment. And he said, that is exactly what it's not. It's not thinking about enlightenment. That's a very, very poor translation. And he tried other things. But he said, in a way, there is no way of describing Bodhicitta. He said, even the word Bodhicitta is not a good name for the Bodhicitta, because the Bodhicitta is altogether beyond language. And he referred to a short treatise by Nagarjuna, which I later discovered was the Bodhicitta Vivarana, the showing of the Bodhicitta. And in this work, Nagarjuna says that the Bodhicitta is not to be found in the five skandhas, in the dhatus and ayatanas, the senses and the sense fields. In other words, it's not to be found anywhere in conditioned existence. It's got nothing to do with constructed conditioned existence. And yet he also says that the Bodhicitta is the great compassionate heart for all beings. But the Bodhicitta cannot be reduced to anything in conditioned existence. And it's very interesting the way Bhante meditates on this in the lecture, the way he reflects on this. He sort of takes it, well, he does take it literally in a sense, by saying, but one of the things he derives from that, as well as the bodhicitta, you can't really verbalise about it, you can't really talk about it. He takes it to mean that the bodhicitta, the force of wisdom and compassion, is nobody's individual and personal possession. You can't say, I have the bodhicitta, and you have the or you don't have the bodhicitta. Probably more to the point. That doesn't apply with the bodhicitta. He says, you know, famously in this lecture, there is only, and don't take this literally, one bodhicitta that manifests in different individuals. And he used the image of many different vessels of water, bowls, lakes, streams, reflecting the same moon. So he started then to talk about the bodhicitta as a sort of, more like a sort of cosmic force. Again, don't take it literally. Don't turn it into a thing. This is poetry. It's not metaphysics, is what people do. We even find this sadly within the order. Oh, he's talking about an Atman. He's talking about a self. He's talking about something substantial. He's not. He's using poetry. He's using poetry to try and evoke something which is beyond language in the end. But he used an image, and he said it was only an image, a simile. It's not the same thing as... rather than to compare the language of the thought of enlightenment with, say, the language, the descent of the Holy Spirit on the disciples of Christ. It's a very, very different kind of language. And he said, the bodhicitta is rather like that. Not the same thing as the Holy Spirit. We're not doing that. We're not going there. He's trying to evoke this idea that when the force of wisdom and compassion arises in you, you don't regard it as yours. This is related to the whole perfection of wisdom language. There is no attainment. There is no attainment. And if a bodhisattva is thinking of attainment, they've missed the point. They've gone astray. It's much more that you have a sense of serving the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, serving the Dharma, serving the bodhicitta. It's a sort of force that sort of inspires you, blows you in your Dharma life to live the Dharma life for the benefit of all. And you don't regard it as your own possession. I found this absolutely thrilling. I suppose, and along with that, the sort of particularly reading works like the Bodhicharavatara, a translation of which had been was around in those days, you also had this sense of tremendous devotion, tremendous rigour as well, intellectual rigour, and this sense of what the Dharma life really is or the metaphors for the Dharma life is not so much I am going to get something. It's much more in terms of worship of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, taking full responsibility for yourself and your Dharma life, doing everything you can to see into the nature of things and opening up to something much greater than you so that you can work more fully and completely for the benefit of all. Over the years, reflecting on it, it seems to me that the Bodhisattva ideal, what it's trying to describe, is a life of selflessness. I don't mean by that sort of self-punishment or something like that. Selflessness in all senses, in a kind of metaphysical sense, in a kind of moral sense, but also you could say in a religious sense, in the sense of really opening up to something greater than higher than you. And that appealed to me hugely as a young man. It really appealed to me. Looking into the Bodhisattva tradition over the years, I remember one of the early books I read was Buddhist Texts Through the Ages. And in that book, Edward Conza has a section on the description of a Bodhisattva from the Ratnagotra Vibhaga. And in this description of a Bodhisattva, there's this wonderful phrase which goes like a fire. He blazes up into working for others,
yet he always remains
in the calm of the dhyanas, the samapatis, the
formless attainments. So the
image you get of a bodhisattva is somebody who is living this intensive life of service,
and yet never departing from the depths of
profound meditation.
Interestingly enough, when Bhante's memoirs came out, The Thousand Petal Lotus,
he quotes that verse. He found that a very, very attractive verse.
Actually, it came out from... He quoted that verse in relation to one of the disciples of Sri Ramakrishna, because in those days Bhante was around the Ramakrishna mission circles,
and one of the Swami disciples of Sri Ramakrishna had this kind of quality, intense outward activity, profound depth of meditation.
That really is,
what better ideal could there be? Living the Dharma life
for the benefit of all,
cultivating not just wisdom but loving kindness and compassion, generosity and so on, living a life of a rich
inner life and of service on
the widest possible scale for the benefit of others. What better ideal could there be? What better adventure could there be? Certainly when I came along, looking back,
the great attraction to getting involved so young was that this is going to be an adventure.
This is going to be a real crack, living this life. What better life could I possibly live?
I remember when I was ordained as well, by Bhante on a weekend retreat in those days.
And not the great, wonderful, sort of systematic, highly supportive
set of things that you have now. It was much more sort of hit and miss in many ways.
But on that retreat, it was so vivid, that the ordination, and feeling from Bhante a tremendous sort of transmission, if you like, or sparking off of an overwhelming energy,
transformative sort of energy, as well as
his example on that weekend. Not only did he ordain Ratnaguna and myself, he just taught the Dharma all weekend, teaching the Shepherd's Search for Mind in this very easy, relaxed, playful manner. Just doing Dharma, Dana, being generous with the Dharma to us, fully, completely.
I remember it so well. It was midsummer, the summer of June 96,
very, very hot summer, and him just
unfolding the Dharma to us, enriching us, pleasing us. And after I was ordained, I thought, right, okay,
well, if I just do my sadhana every day, the meditation I was given at my ordination,
definitely
within 2 years' time the bodhicitta will arise. That's great, because then I'll just be blown along by this force of wisdom and compassion, enlightenment will be assured, and I'll be dispensing kind of blessings and everything else to living beings on the way. It'd be effortless.
Dodgy thinking, Padmavajra, very highly suspect, because that was, I have to admit, there's a kind of slight downside to my interest in the bodhicitta, because it sounded that you didn't really have to make much effort.
You somehow clicked into it, and then you're just,
sort of sailing down to enlightenment with everybody coming with you.
I was 19, so I think it's forgivable, that.
Perhaps it was, that has actually happened, but... And all the other sort of challenges that have come my way over the years are just, as Vimalakirti says, they're just bodhisattvas taking the form of different maras to test my resolve. But that would be a bit grandiose as well. I keep, even with all the sort of challenges that have gone on, this way of looking at the Dharma life in terms of the arising of the bodhicitta,
that's like, the mother's milk of my Dharma life. I took it all in as a very young man. It's part of me.
It's part of the whole way of looking at things. I can't change don't want to change that way of thinking. But of course it has developed over the years. And it's developed because, again, of Bhante's thinking, his own insights into the nature of the bodhicitta and the nature of the order, kind of tied in together. As time went on, he started to talk about, well, if the bodhicitta is nobody's personal possession, it's far more likely to arise within a community. Within a community practicing the Dharma very, very intensively. The bodhicitta is as it were, the inspiration, the force of a spiritual community. He started to talk about the order itself. At its very, very best, when the wind is in the right direction, on a very, very good day, as being a reflection of the 11-headed and 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara. And of course, Avalokiteshvara holds at his heart the Chintamani, which symbolises the bodhicitta. So that the bodhicitta should be at the heart of the order. So order members are aspiring to awaken. And the different hands with the eyes and the implements are each order member's individual and particular expression of that bodhicitta. So, and it's through and in the bodhicitta that we arrive at the profoundest possible harmony within the order. It doesn't come through just, you know, it's good to have organisation, it's good to have institutions, you need them, you need these structures, these worlds to come into. But in the end, if we want deep harmony between us, there has to be a transcendence of our own individuality, no matter how positively that is developed, and to emerge into this entirely different realm of communication, of unity and harmony and particularity. That's what we're looking for within our order and spiritual community. He also talked around this time when these insights were developing in terms of the order metta, the metta bhavana, where we do the metta bhavana to all order members throughout the world on the same day at the same time each month. Very, very important practices, sort of realizing the unity and harmony of the order on this level of the bodhicitta. That's what we're really about. That's what we're talking about. And then recently, the paper a few years ago, that the suprapersonal force, which is well worth reading, trying to open up a way of talking about the Dharma life, if you like, certainly in terms of the arising of the bodhicitta. So this is why I'm an order member. This is why I'm a disciple of Bhante. This is why I have the friendships I have, because I share this vision with so many people. This is why I've done the different things that I've done, and even got into quite difficult situations. Because one of the things that goes with a vision of Dharma life like this is that you have to really get into communication with people. Intensity of communication with people. And that isn't always straightforward. It's challenging, it's demanding, it's difficult. We are still pioneers. We must really remember that. We're 50, nearly. It's very, very young. Very, very young for any kind of spiritual community. We're not a highly established, well worked out community. We are very, very primitive. It's very important to think about that in years to come. If we're still, you know, if there's still some memory of us, you know, historians, kind of Buddhist historians, will write articles on those mysterious, strange, archaic, early modern Buddhists. Looking at the sort of heroic things that they were doing and the things they were trying to do, as well as the different mess-ups they made at different times as well. But it's very, very important to remember that. It's not that the pioneering phase happened in the late 60s and 70s. This is pioneering. You are pioneers. Not young pioneers, Eva, just to say. But we are pioneers in the Dharma life, and we should remember that. Aspiring, novice bodhisattvas.
I was talking last night about an order weekend, and a long time ago, back in the 80s, and we didn't have this shrine room then. The dining room was the shrine room. And on these order weekends, we'd have a massive reporting in. Everybody in the order weekend would sit leaning against the wall, reporting in about their month. Bhante would sometimes come and sit in a big armchair and listen to every single order member's reporting in. Can you believe that? You know, this, and there was, you know, could have been about 50, 60 of us there, big, big things. And Bhante had just done another number of ordinations. He'd led another, or been present on another one of the Tuscany ordination courses, and a very devoted order member, very devotional and emotional order member, stood up and just rejoiced in Bhante's merits. He said, "You've done it again, Bhante. You've ordained all these people, these fantastic new order members who were there speaking about their inspiration from the course and so on." And he couldn't sort of get out the words. And he ended his reporting in, said, "Bhante, you're a bodhisattva." And Bhante said, "Well, we all are." And everybody laughed, you know, and he said, "Oh, that was nice." But of course he meant it. He meant it. He meant that we're all living, we're all the bodhisattva. We're all trying to bring about the bodhicitta and to live the Dharma life fully for the benefit of others. It isn't just him. It's all of us. It's very, very important, I think, to remember these things. So that's a little bit, if you like, about my history in relation to the language of the bodhicitta and the bodhisattva ideal. So we're going to be looking at the way Gampopa discusses the six paramitas of the bodhisattva's path. Before that, he's had two chapters on the arising of the bodhicitta and the taking of the bodhisattva vow. And now he goes into talking about the paramitas. So I want to say something generally, first of all, about the paramitas, or perfections, or transcendental virtues, as they're called. Traditionally, of course, the way the Mahayana explained classical Mahayana explained things, the bodhisattva gives rise to the bodhicitta, takes the great vows to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, and then embarks on the practice of these paramitas on a heroic scale. Then starts practicing generosity, ethics, patience, energy, meditation, and wisdom. You can actually see them described in another way. We were looking on a recent Going for Refuge retreat at some teachings by Atisha and his disciple Geshe Drom. Atisha had a big influence on Gampopa, as did Drom. And Atisha has a wonderful little teaching about how the essence, the one thing you need to know about what the goal of the path is to realise the essence of voidness and compassion, shunyata karana garbha, the complete essence, union of emptiness, wisdom, seeing into the insubstantial nature of all things or people or beings or phenomena, completely unified with a compassionate, loving response to living beings. And Bhante's little commentary on this in the seminar he did on that was saying, the essence of emptiness is compassion, and the essence of compassion is emptiness. Work that out. Very thrilling language, but you've got to do the work on it. And then he talks about, Atisha, how the paramitas are the expression of that realization. He talks about the ever-flowing generosity, the ever-flowing ethics, the ever-flowing
patience. And it's very, very clear that just saying, well, if you really have had a realization, that will be coming out in your behavior. It won't just be in your mind. It's not just going to be for you, because seeing into emptiness is seeing the transcendence of self and others. And what that will look like in relation to others will be generosity and ethics and patience and effort and so on and so forth. It can't not be that. And if it's not that, then it's not the realization of emptiness. It's very, very, very clear on that. You can also look at it another way. And that is that, okay, let's assume that the bodhicitta has not arisen, certainly not arisen fully. We might have a feeling for it. So how can we make it arise? One of the ways you can do that is by practicing the six paramitas. That will lead you to the arising of the bodhicitta. And perhaps that's the best way to look at it when we're looking at the text. That we're seeing the paramitas as a way of bringing about our growth and unfoldment in and through the bodhicitta. It will lead to the full realization of the bodhicitta. In fact, this is sort of worked out quite sort of fully in the tradition, in a very scholastic way. They show how each of the paramitas strengthens the bodhicitta that may have arisen within us. So what I'm going to do is go through the paramitas, not the way Gampopa does, that would be here forever. I just want to pick out some things that really struck me when he talked about each of the paramitas. So first of all, dana, generosity. As a sort of general point here, one of the things that always struck me in Bhante's expositions, whether of the paramitas or indeed the Eightfold Path, when in the lecture on perfect emotion, he says the first manifestation of spiritual experience, transcendental experience, of some sort of seeing through self and other, some sort of state of grace, even if you prefer that sort of language, or whatever language you care for, as a visionary experience, the first manifestation is generosity. It's not clever thoughts, it's generosity. The feeling of wanting to give actually expressed in action. That's the first manifestation of deep change. Wherever you need to look in the tradition, this is what you find. I said earlier that Shantideva, the first thing he does with the arising of the bodhicitta is to give, in this case, to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And there's a lot on generosity in his text. And going with that is a feeling of tremendous gratitude and that expressed in thanksgiving. I think there's a whole set of emotions, if you like, gratitude, thanksgiving, generosity, that are all sort of involved with one another. If you've really been touched deeply by the Dharma, this is what you can sort of expect. If that's not there, then generosity can become a bit of a discipline to help you to become more aware of other people, less sort of concerned with yourself. Generosity is you can also see it as, instead of being focused entirely on yourself, looking out to see what you can do for others, creating a much more of a what Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche once called a panoramic awareness, an awareness that goes out, that embraces the world around you. You can practice it on this retreat. See, somebody needs something, well, go and give it to them. Don't wait to be asked, anticipate. And you can also see that in perhaps in your local centre. You see people working hard for the Dharma, they need help. How can you help? What can you do? In the early days, Bhante said he was around quite a few hippies or wannabe hippies or ex-hippies. And there's a lot of passivity and expectation. And this is where he said it's almost as if people felt it was their sort of right to be endlessly given to.
and not sort of really do anything. This is where he famously said, the Dana bowl is the spiritual barometer of the centre. The health of the Dharma, the Dana bowl, shows how serious people are about the Dharma. Have they really been touched by the Dharma? The whole atmosphere of people volunteering is a sign of the health of the centre. Yes, of course, there's other things like understanding the Dharma and meditation and all that sort of thing. But what does it look like in materiality? We've got to make Dharma life, turn it into materiality. It's the greatest sort of challenge of all. Otherwise, it's just a private mental experience. This is very tantric, by the way. When Bhante first took tantric initiation, his Lama friend said, you have to offer cash. Cash is expected. The old tradition, of course, the old tantric tradition was gold. This is the thing you expected to do if you were serious. Because a tantric initiation is, according to the rhetoric of those traditions, it's giving you the way to enlightenment in a single lifetime. So you are going to give absolutely everything. Do you remember Marpa and one of his disciples, not Milarepa, but another one? He turned up for initiation with Marpa, and Marpa was really, really fierce. I think if we went through Marpa's life story, well, I think we shouldn't really stock Marpa's life story because, I mean, abuse doesn't come into it. But anyway, that's another point. But this chap turned up for initiation, and Marpa said, and he brought all his flocks of sheep and goats, and because these are sort of peasant farmers and landowners in the old Tibet. So he brought everything, and Marpa says, you haven't brought everything. How can I give you the initiation? You haven't got everything. He said, well, there's only one goat left, and she's lame. He said, well, you've got to bring her for me. So he had to go back over all these valleys and then carry this goat back to Marpa. But the point that is being made here is that, look, if this Dharma really is that life-changing, you're prepared to give absolutely everything. So Bhante was told, you have to give cash. Not just nice words, not just a few flowers and a present that they don't want. Lucca, money. That's what's required. And the thing is, they don't tell you how much. And Bhante said, it's really, really interesting. He said, I had hardly any money at the time. But then I had to think, well, how much is this worth? How much do I give? He said, it's very interesting what goes through your mind in terms of what you value. So, this is Dana. This is what Dana's about. There's a very striking quotation in the Dhulam that Gampopa makes early on. Enlightenment is not difficult if you give. Enlightenment is not difficult if you give. Now that's an interesting phrase. We all want enlightenment. We all want to be liberated. It's not difficult if you can give. If you can give yourself. Bhante was very fond, wasn't he, of that famous saying of Walt Whitman, behold, I do not give lectures or a little charity. When I give myself. And Shantideva, of course, says, Nirvana is the giving up of everything, and my heart longs for Nirvana. And if I'm to give up everything, then let me give it to beings. And he really does mean everything. His body, his reputation, everything. Everything is given. So perhaps reflect a bit on that. Gampopa gets very helpful as well because he talks about the different things that we can give, the different people that we can give to. He talks about giving repeatedly, constant giving, without any regrets, total giving. I think especially important here is to talk about giving for the Dharma. Giving, not just giving the Dharma, not everybody is yet ready to communicate the Dharma to others. But we can certainly support the giving of the Dharma and the creation of these worlds in which the Dharma can happen. This is so tremendously important. There is this horrible habit in the modern world of knocking institutions and being sort of thinking that you're being really radical by poking at them. The creation of institutions is extremely difficult. Extremely difficult. The creation of Buddhist centres is very, very hard. Very, very hard indeed. It always has been hard throughout the Buddhist tradition. And the Buddhist tradition, wherever it's gone, it hasn't just had a few, casual groups. There's always been the establishment of temples and monasteries and orders and communities so that people have got a world to come into in which they can really practice, where they can practice under the best conditions. So think about that. Think about generosity. Think about the ways you can be generous. Then Shila Paramita, and of course in the end you're looking for the generosity where there is no perception of the person giving, the person given to, and the gift given. It doesn't mean there's nothing, but there's an unself-conscious flow of generous activity. You're not thinking self-consciously. You're just a stream of energy, which is benefiting others. Then there's Shila Paramita. It's quite a complex discussion there. Talking about the different patterns of morality found in the Bodhisattva tradition, including Shantideva's very interesting discussions from his section on mindfulness, no less, where you're talking in a way about here, sort of Shila, what you're really cultivating as a Bodhisattva is an ethical sensibility, which isn't just to do with the avoidance of evil and unskillfulness. It's not just to do with restraint, important though that is. Ethics is to do with an empathy. It's concerned with the enrichment of others as the ethics of benefiting sentient beings. So in other words, morality is spoken of in terms of positive good, not simply in terms of how you avoid unskillfulness. And certainly there's no hint of sort of moralizing in the text. Early on, pay attention to a little passage which he quotes from the Bodhisattva Bhumi, where he says the essence of the Bodhisattva ethics is correctly receiving the Bodhisattva precepts, the Bodhisattva vows, from another, from your preceptor. And the implications of that, the reason why that's important, is so that you can develop what's known as Sri and Apatrapya. So Sri is shame in relation to the purity of your own intention to live the Bodhisattva life. You have a feeling for the Bodhisattva life, the Bodhisattva path, and when you notice that you fail in it, you feel a positive sense of shame. Not guilt, not that irrational feeling of dread, but a vivid awareness of letting yourself down, letting the Bodhisattva ideal down. And of course that will happen, but that feeling of shame is skillful. It's a skillful mental event so that you can develop a greater ethical sensibility. And then apatrapya is in relation to your preceptor, your spiritual friend. It's the shame that's generated when you bring to mind your spiritual friend. They hold, if you like, the ideal of the Bodhisattva for you. I've been thinking quite a lot about Bhante and my interactions with him in my life. And I was thinking, well, Bhante, in relation to me, was always kind. Always kind and always encouraging me to take responsibility for myself. That's what he's been in relation to me, in all sorts of ways. The only times, plural, he got fierce with me, and he did get fierce with me a few times, was when I was being unkind about others, when I was being particularly stupid about not paying attention to the needs of others, and even when I was trying to sort of
slag them off in relation to him and get him to sort of support me. He would not have it.
And in fact, that was when he was fierce, even a little bit wrathful with me when I was.
And that's why is why I can bring Bhante to mind if I'm being unkind,
because he's been the example of kindness to me
in all sorts of ways. I'd love to tell you all about that, but there is no time. So then there's the perfection of patience, Kshanti Paramita,
tremendously important. When I was a young lad, first reading the things, patience didn't sound much fun, just
sort of putting up with bad things, you know what I mean? You know, who wants to be patient, being a very impatient person and even irascible on occasion? But a bodhisattva needs, deep wells of patience and forbearance. There is an etymology of Kshanti that is related to the earth. The bodhisattva has to have a patience that just bears everything, like the earth. Because, of course, if you're living a Dharma life and you're really trying to do something to benefit others and you're an imperfect living being, an imperfect person, of course you're going to get stuff chucked at you. Of course, even if you were perfect, you'd get stuff chucked at you because people, are not going to think of you like that. Of course you are. You're going to get absolutely hammered. And of course, the thing is, for a bodhisattva, well, for any Buddhist, you can't retaliate. It's one of the most irritating things about the Buddha's teaching. There is absolutely no justification for anger. There's no justification for anger, righteous indignation, getting on your moral high horse, really being heavy with people. None. You can't do a jihad in Buddhism. It's just not possible. You do a jihad on yourself. By the way, the greater jihad, as they call it in Islam, is the transformation of yourself. I'm not advocating jihad, by the way. This is just for Tom, so it's okay. But anyway, you have to overcome your anger and your hatred and your resentment and your tendency to blame. This is very, very irritating in Buddhist tradition. It's like you try to get really, but all the time you can hear the Buddha talking to you or the great teacher say, no, can't do that. That's not part of the deal. Doesn't mean you're passive. Doesn't mean you don't have energy. Doesn't mean that you don't positively speak up against injustice and, all those things and what's wrong. But if there's anger, resentment, righteous indignation, punishment, all those things, you are not a Buddhist in those moments. You're not going for refuge. You're not on the bodhisattva path. I remember first, before I'd found the movement, seeing the Dalai Lama in an interview on his first visit to the West. And he's asked this question, what do you think about Chairman Mao? And the Dalai Lama said, he is my greatest friend. He is my greatest friend. And I thought, that's a really silly thing to say. He is my greatest friend. He is not my greatest guru. My greatest guru? What is he talking about? Indeed, because he's teaching him patience and love and compassion. And of course, the Dalai Lama is saying that in full awareness of the terrible sufferings that were inflicted on Tibetan people. He's not saying it in a callous way. And of course, then I discovered this is absolutely classic Buddhism. Classic Shantideva Buddhism. Your enemy is your greatest friend. Because they're the person really teaching you metta. Really teaching you loving kindness. This is why I think it's really not a good idea to skip over the stages of the metta bhavana and think that you can develop love without doing the third and fourth stages. I think that's spiritual bypassing. You're just avoiding yourself. You're avoiding your indifference and you're avoiding your aversion. And you'll get nowhere like that. You'll just have an alienated Dharma life. You've got to sit there bringing to mind the person that irritates you or the person who is against you or the many people you're indifferent to. You've got to look into that. You've got to develop a loving kindness that transcends that, transforms that. And it's very, very interesting in this text. Gampopa rehearses the teachings from Shantideva on the way you transform your perception of the enemy in your meditation. You know, they're not bypassing these people. They're engaging with the issues properly. There's also a beautiful definition of patience. A mind without confusion, and with only a feeling of ease, accompanied by compassion. That's an amazing definition. You can meditate on that for a while. A mind without confusion, and with only a feeling of ease, accompanied by compassion. So we're not talking about just gritting your teeth, though that there might be a discipline in that. You're looking for this sense of clarity and ease and compassion. Then virya, which this translator in the text translates as perseverance. Perseverance is a good translation. Energy in pursuit of the good. Vigor, very important. I like the way he talks about laziness. First of all, listlessness. Just having a sort of slothful, passive, dreary life. And he's really concerned with waking us up and really emphasising death meditations there. Look, you could die at any moment. Don't waste your life in passive sleepiness. Wake up, do something. And that applies to everything. You know, if you're not sure about what you're doing in life and you're not sure about this, that and the other, well, ask yourself, have you got time for that kind of luxurious thinking? Have you actually got time? That's a decadent kind of luxury issue, having doubts about what we're doing with our lives. It really is, because it's not taking cognizance of the fact that death is inevitable and it could happen at any moment. So wake up. Don't live a dreary life. Then there's what this translator calls disregard, and here it's faint-heartedness, you know, self-pity. I'm not good enough to live this life. I can't do it. All that kind of narrative. We are not worthy. And somebody told this story that they went to see Bhante, and they were going about how they can't practice and hate themselves and blah, blah, blah. And Bhante said, what makes you think you're so special? Because, of course, it's another kind of conceit. It's just another version of arrogance and conceit. You know, we're used to the, if he was an ice cream, he would lick himself conceit, you know, where we're putting ourselves above everybody and thinking we're the greatest thing, you know, that the world needs. But there is another conceit, which is the view that you are uniquely flawed and inferior. And you are that special case that cannot gain enlightenment. It's one of the things, I could never get away with that with Bhante. I've tried and tried to put that one over on him. Look, I really can't do it, Bhante. And remember a weird phone call with him where, here at Pavloko, and I was sort of manning the office, the order office that we had here, and we were having a bit of a chat. And he asked me how I was, and I said, oh, I'm really missing Subhuti. He's gone, and, but I miss Subhuti. I miss Subhuti being away on retreat. Okay, you know, it's not just you missing him. We're all missing him. And I said, also, Bhante, progress seems so slow, and you know that I can't. There doesn't seem to be anything happening. It's measurable. The growth is measurable. Just kept saying this word measurable. To say, no, I'm not interested in this self pity. You are getting on well. Come on, wouldn't have it. So none of that narrative. Come on. And there's a quote somewhere in here that the Tathagata has said that even worms and gnats can gain enlightenment. And I think what he's getting at is that, well, sometimes we feel worm-like and gnat-like, don't we? And so that's okay. It's fine if you feel like a worm. But you can still gain enlightenment. That's fine. It doesn't matter how you feel. That's sort of irrelevant, how you're feeling. Whatever that feeling is, in that is the potential for enlightenment and living this path. So none of that cop-out. That's a laziness. And then gross laziness is addiction to gaining wealth and subduing enemies. That's being lazy. That's gross. Really gross. Lots of energy,
but it's not in the direction of enlightenment. I think, I'm sure none of you are just addicted to gaining wealth and subduing enemies. I mean, maybe you are, something we need to know about. But busyness, you know, running around doing things that are apparently very important, which actually have no purpose. So it's really demanding that, well, what are we doing? You know, what are we really doing with our lives? What's our purpose and aim? And after that, he talks about putting on the armour, which I think is really building up aspiration and inspiration, cultivating the desire to live this life every day. We're creatures of desire. You know, you can't get round desire. Desire's got to be incorporated in our Dharma life. That's why we have all the imagery, all the mythologies, all the stories, all the emphasis on friendship and the emotional engagement, the imaginative engagement in Dharma. You need that if you're going to put forth energy in Dharma life. So look at that. Meditation, dhyana. Very, very clear that meditation, yes, is for the cultivation of seeing into the nature of things, deep seeing, but also the development of qualities for others. This is something very, very important about the Bodhisattva path. It's not just about the removal of ignorance, which is sort of negative. It's about the creation of character. This is what the Bodhisattva really is. We're trying to become big characters. We're trying to develop great qualities, become creative characters with each other to really enrich this world. It's not just about seeing into things, though that's there. It's about becoming big characters to enrich the world. Transcendent characters. You look at the figures on the refuge tree. They're characters, extraordinary characters. Strange characters, you know, who've enriched the tradition. That's what we're concerned with. That's what meditation is about. What all these paramitas are about. He talks about these different vivekas, these different solitudes or isolations. It's a bit hard to translate viveka. Kaya viveka, removing ourselves from involvement in worldly activities. In other words, going into retreat. Or each day, we close everything down. We switch off all the gadgets. We go into a silent room to meditate. We need the good conditions. You need to take your body and away from things that pull you out to go in meditation. And then citta viveka, taking the mind away from the kleshas. And he gives a particular list of poisons, of kleshas, that you have to deal with if you're to successfully meditate. So lust, you know, very intense craving. He recommends the classic meditation on the ugliness of things. Bhante's not very keen on that. He doesn't think that's so good. He recommends death meditation for this. Or meditation on beauty. But this is where our meditation on the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are. He says that's a shubha bhavana, the development of pure beauty, to take yourself away from involvement in gross desire. Hatred has to be overcome through maitri bhavana, metta bhavana. Ignorance needs to be overcome through contemplation of pratityasamutpada, especially the different nidana. Change the links in conditioned co-production. We do a retreat on that, by the way. This being that becomes that meditation. Very good retreat. Jealousy, envy needs to be overcome through realizing the sameness of self and others. Gives a little meditation from Shantideva. And pride and conceit needs to be overcome through imaginative identification with others. Sort of extensions of metta, really, these two. And if the kleshas are, you're not, you know, the poisons are sort of, you're not sure which ones, and they're all a bit in play, mindfulness of breathing. Very interesting set. And then he talks about dhyana, the importance of dwelling in highly concentrated, positive states of mind. Shamatha, bhavana, very, very important. And the development of qualities to benefit others. And we do this in order to prepare for prajnaparamita, wisdom. It's very important that you have all this.
So then he talks about wisdom awareness, as it's translated here, the perfection of wisdom, prajnaparamita.
Very, very important to develop prajnaparamita. Without it, all other practices are blind.
They don't have direction.
We need to have wisdom and awareness. Otherwise, we can get into a lot of difficulties.
At the same time, he quotes Vimalakirti,
Vimalakirti Nideshan, that makes it very clear that wisdom and what's called method are in absolute unity. Prajna and upaya, prajna and wisdom and means, must be in unity. So that means you've got to practice the five other paramitas as well. If you don't, then you are in bondage. Wisdom alone, seeing alone, is not enough. He even quotes a text which says, that means you're in the grip of Mara.
If there is just means alone, just the other five paramitas, you're in the grip of Mara. You need to practice all of the paramitas for a rounded development, for real liberation. Very interesting material. He talks about levels of wisdom as well, or different kinds of wisdom. I think this is really interesting. He begins with learning.
He talks about it's not just to do with insight; it's the different kinds of sciences and arts and culture,
even things like medicine. He's talking about that there is such a wisdom as a sort of human wisdom. It's something I've been reflecting on quite a lot lately. That when you go through Buddhist texts, when they talk about wisdom, they're not simply talking about seeing things like the Lakshanas.
They're talking about human wisdom that needs to be cultivated. You know, things like all the others do not realise that we're all heading for death. Those who do realise it will compose their quarrels. Dhammapada, verse 6, I think. Making it, you know, that's wisdom. That's knowing. You know that
death can come at any moment, so you practice metta very, very strongly. And there's something, I think, as I said a few years ago, that when I first heard Bhante quote that, I thought that
means that the Buddha is enlightened in that particular phrase. It's so elegant, simple, human.
Basic Buddhism, we need to have an insight into wisdom about karma. And its effects is tremendously important.
That's the basic insight. That actions,
our actions, have consequences for ourselves and others. And yes, insight into shunyata, into emptiness. There's great concern in Gampopa to establish the middle way. He does that Indo-Tibetan thing of highly dialectical discussions to refute eternalism, nihilism, both and neither. I find this all a bit skull-cracking myself. I don't go in for it. But I think, really, the one we need to pay attention to is the wrong view of nihilism, non-existence. I think that is far more of a problem than eternalism for we modern Westerners. I really do think that's a very, very big problem. In some ways, I think the language of emptiness and not self is deeply unhelpful because it opens up a valueless world. And I think that's actually what's happening in some circles. And I think it's very, very dangerous. In some ways, I wish we didn't have that language. I wish we had another word for what shunyata is conveying, like life, energy, something like that. Sorry, this sounds terribly heretical, but I'm not being heretical.
Because it quotes from a sutra where it says to have the wrong view of shunyata,
a nihilistic view, is much worse.
Sorry, is to have a wrong view of self, to have a view of self, of existence, as high and as central as Mount Meru is much better than a wrong view of Shunyata. Much, much better. Because if you've got a wrong nihilistic view of Shunyata, you've turned medicine into poison. And if you turn medicine into poison, you really can't be cured. It's very, very important. And it's interesting that Meru is the central mountain. So if you have a view that you are the centre of everything, well, that's in a way quite good. That's healthy, actually. We all are extremely important to ourselves. But you can use that to identify with everybody else, because everybody else regards themselves as the centre of the universe. This is a meditation that Shantideva gives. You know, you don't want to be treated badly. You want to feel well. You want to feel protected. Everybody else is the same. You are no different from everybody else. That is the best entry into Shunyata. To see the profound sameness of self and other by recognising our fundamental living beingness and humanness. Much, much better than a wrong view of emptiness. So, have a good look at that. He also gives the signs of wisdom. I think if you're interested in developing wisdom, in seeing into the nature of things, it's a very good idea to see what the aim of that is. What it actually looks like. Forget all the sort of, you know, the paradoxical language and all that sort of thing. What does a man of wisdom look like? So he says, the signs of the practice of wisdom are that we care for the good and the wholesome, the skillful. The kleshas, the defilements, will diminish. Compassion towards sentient beings will arise. One will earnestly make effort towards reality. One will abandon all distractions and unrest, and one will neither grasp nor become attached to this life. So that's the way you assess wisdom. Does it look like that? We care for the good and the wholesome. Care for the good and the wholesome. The kleshas, the defilements, will diminish. Compassion towards all sentient beings will arise. One will earnestly make effort towards reality. One will abandon all distractions and unrest, and one will neither grasp nor become attached to this life. Wonderful words.